This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Joy of Text. We're coming to you live from our first stop on our college tour at Princeton University. My name is Rabbah Raimi Smith, and I'm the moderator of this podcast. With me to discuss tonight's topic is Rabbi Dov Linder, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, President of Drofa and Clinical Director of Maze Women's Health. Because we're on a college campus, we picked a much-discussed topic, hookup culture. As I'm sure everyone knows, hooking up is defined differently by different people, so for the sake of today's discussion, we're defining a hookup as a brief, uncommitted sexual encounter between individuals who are not romantic partners or dating each other. Dr. Marcus, can you kick off this conversation?
So we just thought we'd start by discussing the fact that people talk a lot about the hookup culture. Is it a real thing? Is it really happening? Is it actually a new thing? And then I guess we want to move into it. Is it a good thing? Those are kind of the questions that we wanted to discuss today. So one of the things that really struck me, you know, we're doing a little bit of research on this. Everybody has their own experience, and everybody sees the part of the elephant that they recognize, right? You're standing next to the trunk, you see the trunk. You're standing next to the legs, you see the legs. But the question is, you know, is the hookup culture, as we hear about it, kind of a real thing? So one of the most interesting pieces of data that I think is important for us all to pay attention to is the fact that millennials actually have less sexual partners than baby boomers in the same period of time. Some of you might have seen that statistic. I think it was actually in the New York Times, you know, a few months ago. But it really brings us up short because everybody's talking about, oh my God, everybody's hooking up all over the place with everybody else. That's sort of the sense. And the reality is that I'm not 100% sure that that's the case, because in the end, the statistic is such that millennials are having fewer sexual partners than their baby boomer counterparts. So the question kind of is, what fuels this discussion? Like, what makes people think that things are so much wilder and crazier now? And this is kind of where we want to start the conversation. There is a concept, specifically on college campuses, where you see people who basically every Friday night or Saturday night, the plan is that they're going to go out, get drunk, and have sexual encounters with people that they may not know well, or certainly people that they're not in a relationship with. That is a concept, I think, that is considered kind of new. And the question that I've been struggling with, is that a new concept because it's something that's sort of more planful? Because before this, people didn't talk about the fact that they were doing this on a regular basis, right? People just sort of did it or didn't do it. But if they did do it, it wasn't because that was part of the regular plan, right? On Monday I have class, on Tuesday I have class, on Wednesday I have class, on Friday night and Saturday night, I am going to get drunk and hook up with people. So to a certain degree, I think that may be where this is stemming from. And before I kind of move on and talk a little bit what the data shows in terms of people's enjoying it or not enjoying the situation, I guess I want to get some sort of feedback from you two about, does it exist? Does it not exist? What do you guys think?
I have no idea. I just know what I read.
Right. And what do you read?
Some of the stuff is very salacious and sounds like that it's happening all the time and that it's much more frequent than it has been in the past. And then other studies seem to indicate that things are not so different. But I definitely have a sense, and sometimes it's associated with apps and Tinder and those types of issues, that certainly that helps, I think, make it more tantalizing and concrete and real. Like, people have a sense, oh, you just use your app and you can then find a hookup, although I know it happens without that. But it certainly seems to me that if it's not happening more frequently, it's more part of the culture. It's more owned. It's more recognized.
A lot of the studies and statistics I was reading before today, they talked about how because people are sexually active for a longer period of time because they get married later, it seemed to suggest that they might have more sexual partners. So I was actually very surprised to hear that millennials have fewer sexual partners, especially growing up as a millennial. I think we're constantly told you have so many sexual partners, so we assume everyone has so many sexual partners. But I was very fascinated to hear that we actually have fewer and where we go from that. So we have fewer, but still, is it good? Is it bad?
So I think part of what happens with the advent of all of these dating apps, like Tinder and what are the rest of the
ones? J-Swipe
and Bumble. Like a whole, right? So I think people are blaming those apps often for the kind of casual sex that you see happening all around you. But there's a guy named John Berger, who wrote a book called Datanomics. Did anybody read that? How Data Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. I'd recommend take a look at the book. But one of the things he points out is that he thinks this whole casual sex thing has very little to do with technology. As a matter of fact, there was a point where people thought casual sex had started because of the advent of the motor car, right? Like people, they could escape to the cars.
And so, then I got the telephone wasn't too helpful.
The telephone wasn't helpful, exactly. So as technology changes, people are always blaming that on, oh my God, it's a new generation and they're all sleeping around. And it comes up again and again. And one of the things he makes the point of, which is really fascinating, is that post-World War I in 1920s Europe, there was a huge gender gap, right? A lot of the guys had been killed in the war. And so there were many, many more women for men. And in every generation when there's more women available than men, that's when you see casual sex on the rise, as opposed to a situation when there's more men available than women, and then all of a sudden the relationship flips and there has to be a courtship and a more relationship building if the men want to have sex with the women, as opposed to a casual situation where there's so many women out there, the men feel like they can sleep with as many women as possible. Now, the problem with my saying this is that there's a sort of subtle gender bias, right? That women don't want to have casual sex, right? And men do want to have casual sex. I'm going to make the argument that nobody really loves casual sex, but that somehow, certainly in our sociological narrative, men are supposed to like casual sex. And so men often will get caught up in that casual sex element way more than women will. But I really do think that one of the things that he says in this book is that the imbalance has really spilled into college campuses. So that there are now 5.5 million college-educated women in the United States between the ages of 22 and 29, and there are 4.1 million college-educated men. So it's a huge disparity. And the dating pool for straight millennial college graduates has 4 women for every 3 men. So men are never in a rush to settle down because there's like a huge number of women out there. Whereas women, if they're interested in forming a long-term relationship, have it much trickier. So I actually thought that was a pretty convincing argument. And I will talk a little bit more about women in the quote unquote hookup culture. There's a book called Girls and Sex. I don't know if anybody out there has read it, which talks a lot about girls sort of taking that narrative more like, I too can have casual sex, but whether or not they're actually really happy in that situation is kind of an interesting question. So that's what I want to say about the reality. I can keep talking forever unless somebody shuts me up, but I can move on and talk a little bit about how satisfying casual hookup sex is.
Can I just jump in before you do?
For sure.
Okay, I wanted to say, I think what you're saying is really resonating with me, and it's reminding me of things that people are saying about startups that have unlimited vacation days and how actually having unlimited options means that you take fewer vacation days. And what dating apps do is they give you a seemingly unlimited amount of options of people to date or to hook up with. So you might assume that because you have this huge pool, you're more sexually active. But what we're seeing is that's actually not the case. Having more options means you're less sexually active, and also you do it from your couch, and there's all these discussions.
You and I were talking about what those dating apps actually produce.
Yeah.
Very few produce sex.
Has anyone read Aziz Ansari's book, Modern Romance? If you haven't, it's phenomenal. What he talks about a lot is the phenomenon in dating apps that we call them dating apps, but we don't actually treat them as dating apps. We treat them as meeting apps. And if we want to use them as dating apps, then what people need to do is meet someone, have a very brief conversation, and then go have a drink or a cup of coffee. But what ends up actually happening is people text or chat for a week or two, and then someone ghosts or it just fades out, and no one's actually dating from it. So it might seem like there's all these options to date people, but fewer people are actually taking advantage of the opportunity to go on a date and actually make a romantic connection with someone.
Or have sex with them.
Or have sex with
them. Right, exactly. Before I jump into the whole, is this actually work for people or does this not work for people, do you want to talk a little bit about?
I think I want to actually respond to, at first, I'd ask you to describe the phenomenon and how that's playing out for people at the relationship and emotional level, and then I'll jump in with some thoughts about Otoa's perspective on all of this.
So my gut is sort of funny, because if you've been listening to this podcast for the last year and a half, or when we've been producing this podcast, you'll see that I pretty much say, everything goes. Like, I'm pretty good, right? So, I mean, I think there's halachic problems with things, but from a sexual perspective, I'm very slow to judge anything negatively when it comes to sex. However, I will say that as much as I have been able to research, talk to people, see patients, for the most part, sex when you're hooking up is not great sex. Just like, now I'm not making a value judgment. I will leave the value judgment for Rabbi Linzer to make. but I am just making quality judgment here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sex is complicated. We would really like to feel like sex is an easy thing and natural. And honestly, and I'm now going to get a little bit on a soapbox, I think one of the big myths that we get told our whole lives is you're going to have sex with somebody and you're in a relationship and hopefully the sex is good. If it's not good, get help. But then once you've got the sex thing worked out, that's it. You're done. Just ride off into the sunset for the rest of your life having sex with this person. It so could not be further from the truth. I mean, people change and develop and emotionally as well as physically, and all kinds of problems arise. And having a good sex life for your whole life is really complicated and a lot of work. I think it's worth it, but I think it's really complicated and a lot of work. But one of the basic parameters of good sex is not only being attracted to the person, but being able to communicate with that person, being able to say to the person, this is what I need and this is what I want and this worked for me and this doesn't work for me. And when you're hooking up with somebody, there's no space for that at all. I'm getting a lot of nodding heads. So I think that that's really, really incredibly important. Also, there's an issue of trusting and safety. You need to feel safe for the most part to have a good sexual experience, and you don't have that often when you're, you know, somebody you met an hour ago. But I will give you some statistics in case you don't believe me, because that has always been my sense. So 82% of men said they were generally glad they had had a hookup, while only 57% of women said that. That was one study. Another study said basically 50% of men reported having had a positive reaction the day after having a hookup, and 26% of women felt like they had a positive reaction. So I think one of the things you see is that I'm not crazy, that only 65% of people report feeling good while they're having the hookup. And there was a statistic on orgasm that Ramey and I were discussing. I'm going to find it. But it was a crazy small number of people that reported male and female having orgasms during that hookup. And the number of people who sort of felt regretful afterwards was also incredibly high. What's interesting is the more alcohol-fueled the hookup is, the more likely there is to be penetrative sex, which I think is kind of interesting in and of its own right, and the more people don't even remember what happened. So it's hard to feel regret or happy if you can't even put your finger on what actually occurred the night before. I don't think it's great sex. I mean, when all is said and done, I do not think this is a recipe for fabulous sex. And so I wonder a little bit about why people do it, and I have some thoughts as to why people do it, but...
Do you want the stat?
Yeah, let's give it a stat.
Okay, this study is evaluating relationships and one-time hookups. In both contexts, men reached orgasm more often than women, but in first-time...
Big surprise.
In first-time hookups, 31% of men and 10% of women reached orgasm. That is a small percentage in both cases.
Pretty not fun, guys. And that's assuming they were trying to have an orgasm.
Yeah, and in relationship sexual activity, 85% of men and 68% of women reached orgasm. So the difference between relationship and one-night stand is very glaring.
Very glaring, right.
So, yeah, that's a great place to jump in, because I want to talk about two things. One is a perspective on Torah values about sex. I think that unfortunately the discourse tends always to be about halacha, and then when there are things that are not sanctioned by halacha, then it's as if the Torah has nothing to say about the issue. And there's really a lot to look at in terms of a Torah sexual ethic, regardless of the specific question of whether this is within the bounds of halacha or not within the bounds of halacha. So I would like to first address that issue, and then I do want to talk about what I think is a challenge about what it means when people are, you know, have been told your whole lives about, or some of you, about what these sort of halachic boundaries are, and then a sense about the temptations, and can I really live by these boundaries? And often there's a sense like, if I'm going to cross these boundaries, I might as well just, then there's no limits after that. So let me first talk about some Torah values about this. I think that one interesting place to look at is the difference between words that the Torah uses to describe the act of sex. Someplace the Torah uses the word biah, which really means to enter into, and that's a very physical definition, anatomical definition of the act. The Torah also, though, you know, going back to the very first story in Bereishit, speaks about to know. And Adam knew Chava, his wife. And I think that that's a very powerful term, because it speaks about the idea that the act of sex, certainly ideally, is really about knowing the other person, connecting to the other person. As we just heard, you know, you have to really be in communication and know the person to know what it is that they want and how to give the person pleasure. But there's also the sense that you expose yourself, and I don't just mean in the physical sense, to somebody that you're having that intimacy with and that you're having sex with. And that really can create emotional entanglement, and hopefully, if it's in a healthy context, a deep emotional connection, which gets to the next part of the verse, which is that they shall be one flesh. Actually, that's an earlier verse. A person shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they'll be one flesh. And Ramban comments on that, and he says, you know, what's unique about the human experience? Why is the human experience described that way, in a way that for animals, they also have sex? And he says, well, for animals, it's just about the act. And for human beings, the act, hopefully, I'm adding the hopefully, but the act really brings them together in a powerful way and connects them in a deep emotional type of a way, or certainly can. And I think that when it doesn't, but because it has those qualities, then often people can feel that they've been violated or that they're emotions have been toyed with. And certainly, as we've heard, the sex itself can be significantly impacted. So that's, I think, one interesting area. And I want to say another word, which is important about this. When the Torah speaks about forbidden acts of sex, and the Torah there speaks about gilui erva, which is to uncover nakedness. And that, I think, speaks to two elements in which I was addressing. You know, there is a sense in which you reveal something very intimate and private about yourself, both your body and other aspects of who you are. And in the right context, that can be very powerful and healthy. And in the wrong context, to have your nakedness revealed can be a sense of violation. So I think that even looking at those words gives us a way of thinking about different components of the sexual act. Let me talk about one other point. You know, the Gemara in Nedarim speaks about what type of sex is permitted between husband and wife. And initially, it lists certain types of acts, which according to one opinion are forbidden. But then this gets rejected. It says, no, it doesn't matter. You can do whatever acts you want between husband and wife. But then it says there are some things which are forbidden. And the things which are forbidden don't have to do with what type of physical act is being done, but the moral quality of the act and the way in which you're using the other person or taking advantage, connecting or not connecting to the other person. So, for example, the Gemara says that it has to be with full consent. It even says not only does that mean not rape, but it uses a phrase like you can't feel that you're being somehow forced into it, even at an emotional level. It says that you have to really be connecting to this person in front of you, not using them as a stand-in for somebody else. And maybe most importantly, it says that you can't be drunk, either party can't be drunk, they can't be fighting, they can't be in a way in which this is not about connecting in a way that respects the other person. So even if both parties agree, let's say both parties decide to go ahead and get drunk, or they're fighting with one another. Gemara imagines a couple fighting with one another. Okay, so we're fighting, but no reason not to have sex tonight just because we're in a fight. And the Gemara says, no, actually there is a reason, because you can wind up using each other, even if it's sort of reciprocal using, and it's really a sense of violation that can occur to both couples. So it's really not even when it's lopsided. So there's a lot that the Gemara says about values and an ethics of sex, which really apply under any sexual relationship, regardless of whether it's operating within halacha or not. So I have more to say, but I'd like to hear some thoughts on that.
Well, yeah. I think the idea that sex goes beyond what's happening at that moment with putting A in slot B or C on slot D, right? That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a much broader, bigger picture. I'm curious as to why people have this kind of sex. Like, it's such crappy sex. So like, why are people doing it? You know? So one is, you know, I think people hope it'll always be better next time. I think there's peer pressure. Mm-hmm. When we open this up for people to talk, I'd love to hear from you guys what that feels like. I think there's this idea that we're all supposed to feel like sex can be casual, sex can be fun, sex doesn't have to take planning, you don't have to be in a relationship to have sex. And to a certain degree, I think sometimes that makes sense. But I really do wonder if people are having quite as much sex as people think that they're letting on to. There was another statistic I saw that I thought was really mind-boggling, which is that the data was showing that if you ask people how many hookups people estimate that people have in college, they would estimate 7 hookups a semester. Mm-hmm. In reality, the number is 7 during their entire college career. That's a huge difference, right? 7 times 8.
Eight times.
7 times 8, right? Versus just 7. So I think there's a peer pressure thing. I think, and here's where I wonder where it, and we should talk about this, in the more traditional Orthodox or religious communities, whether the drunkenness gives you kind of a cover to do things that you might want to do and not necessarily feel right about doing. And so you don't have to really think about things. You can just get drunk. So I do feel like in the Orthodox community, people I speak to often don't use birth control because using birth control is acknowledging that they're going to be sexually active. And it's much more comfortable to say, oh, well, I wasn't planning on being sexually active. I just got drunk or I just did something not thinking about it. And so I didn't use birth control because birth control would have meant I had been planning it in advance. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that sort of plays into this also. There was a statistic here that
45% of hookups are unsafe sex, which is also a really mind-blowing statistic.
Correct. But it makes sense when you think about it, right? Because you're drunk. It's not planned. You're not thinking about it. You're not using good judgment. And then the other thing I also wonder about is if, and I've talked to some women who talk about, it feels like short-term self-confidence boosters. And I say I talk to women. The men aren't my patients, so I don't get to talk to them as frequently as I talk to women, kind of on a one-to-one basis. But there's this idea of, like, I'm feeling lonely, I'm feeling crummy about myself, but I'm going to go hook up with somebody, and for a few short, fleeting moments, I'm going to feel like somebody wants me. I matter to somebody. It's important to somebody. But I don't think that has a long-lasting impact. And so it feels good, but it's like eating the 12 donuts. It really gives you a stomachache afterwards.
I want to jump in and respond to the issue about getting drunk, because I spoke a moment ago about the idea of drunkenness during the act of sex as a way in which you're not relating fully to the other person with a full, clear mind. But there's another part which I think is what you're talking about, which is a way of distancing self from what you're about to do. And I think that that maybe becomes really an issue, I would guess, I don't have any statistics, within the Orthodox community. If people are tempted, and I don't know what type of pressures play out here, just opportunity or a sense that everybody is doing it, so a desire to do it because everybody else is, but then how can I go ahead and do it? I know I'm not supposed to. I know there's halacha, whatever. So sometimes I imagine that getting drunk is a way of allowing yourself to do it without owning a responsibility about what you're about to do. And in a way, you actually have a story that's somewhat similar to this, based on how the rabbis read it in the Torah about Lot. Lot gets drunk, and his older daughter sleeps with him, and then it says the next morning his younger daughter sleeps with him. So the rabbis say that when, in the Torah, when it says that his older daughter got up the next morning, it says he did not know when she lay down with him and when she got up, and it says there's actually a dot over the word when she got up, because he actually did know when she got up, and he was aware about what was going on, at least after the fact, and he let himself get drunk the second night. So, you know, knowing what it's going to mean, but somehow persuading yourself that it's not going to happen, or you don't want to own what's going to happen, and therefore you let yourself get drunk. And I think that that's a real problem. I think just the sense of self-distancing from your actions in general, not taking responsibility, but also I think religiously and emotionally there's going to be price to pay if people feel that they have these temptations, that they want to be having sex, and so on. I think part of the problem is what I said earlier, that I think that we tend to treat it as all or nothing. So we never learn a sense of, you know, I think that in the Orthodox community, we feel maybe we teach our kids certain halachot, and that's going to take care of it, and we as parents don't have to talk about a sexual ethics or knowing yourself, knowing your limits, knowing what you do want to do, don't want to do, and we don't talk about different degrees within halacha. Things are not all the same within halacha. And I think that if we could own that sense of gradation, both from a halachic standpoint, and we could own in sense of owning a personal responsibility to make responsible acts and decisions and know what your boundaries are and keep to those boundaries and be intentional about it, that people will be a lot more satisfied and a lot less regret in the following morning.
Right. I wanted to basically say what you just said, except I feel like it's a much bigger challenge than you're pointing out, right? Because as a religious community, we don't feel like we have the right to say, and I often get my back pushed up against the wall when people say to me, well, does that mean I should be having sex or forget sex? I should be having physical relationships before I get married. And, you know, we're in this complicated catch-22 that I think makes the world much harder for religious students, because no authorities is going to say yes. I mean, I maybe say yes because I have no rabbinic authority, right? Nobody cares what I say. But any rabbinic authority is going to have a very hard time answering that question.
Right. You could certainly say it's better to do A than to do B than to do C. And I think that people are afraid to say that because then it says, oh, so you're telling me it's okay to do A and B as long as
right.
I don't do C. But I think that there's a big price to pay if you treat it all as one big non-differentiated type of a prohibition. So talk about gradations, right? And I want to say something about that issue, that that's a real act of owning your responsibility for for what you're about to do. So again, I want to be clear. I'm not going ahead, and this is always the hesitation everybody has about talking about this. Oh, so Rabbi Linzer just said. Okay. So I am not giving any license or permission for anything which is not allowed, but I do want to say that if somebody is going to have sex, and rather than getting drunk and distancing themselves from their own action, actually makes a conscious decision to go to the mikveh, if we're talking about the woman, not only does it make it infinitely better from a halachic standpoint, it really means that you are being very intentional and owning that responsibility, and I think that's certainly a much more healthy choice.
But you still wouldn't suggest somebody go to the mikveh in order to start hooking up.
No, absolutely not. Thank you.
The only other thing I want to clarify before we wrap up this section is that, you know, I want to just touch on the feminist issue of this, because I feel like this often, like, men like hooking up, women don't like hooking up, somehow the women getting taken advantage of. And I feel like part of what happened in the hookup culture recently is that women sort of said, look, I can be sexual just like a man can be sexual. The same way he can just go out and have sex and not have relationships and not think about it, I can do the same thing. And I don't think women are happy, but I want to be really clear. I don't think the men are so happy either. I don't think this is good for anybody. I think in a certain direction, it may be worse for women, because I think the women often hold themselves to a certain higher standard that often men don't. But I don't think it's a useful, great way to have sex on the whole. And so that's where I'm coming from in terms of any negativity you're hearing. I also want to be really clear. It's not like I think it screws you up for life. Like, I'll have patients who come in who hooked up with 50 people in college, and so they did their test statistic, right? 7 every semester. And I don't know that that has a negative impact long term. I'm not saying, oh my God, you shouldn't be hooking up because it's going to ruin your chance for having a good, meaningful sexual relationship, or your chance for meeting a guy, or you'll become spoiled goods, or any of those things. I just don't think it's great sex, and I don't think people feel good about themselves afterwards. And neither of those things do I think are valuable. So I want to be really clear that that's where I was coming from with this.
Great, thank you. Next up, insights from our live audience. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Hi everyone, it's Shira from Jofa, and I'm here to talk to you about our blog now being hosted by the Jewish Week. Jofa's blog is a place for you to voice your thoughts on anything and everything related to Jewish feminism, from feminist readings of this week's Parsha to what it's like to date as a Jewish feminist. The possibilities are endless, as long as you remain within our 1,000-word word limit. If you're interested in writing, contact me, Shira, at shira@jofa.org. I mean it. Contact me today, like right now. Pause this episode and send me an email. I'll be waiting.
So we thought that for the second part of this thing, we'd love to hear from you guys, because you guys are living on the college campus. We're not. We wish we were, but we're not. So we have a mic up here, and we'd love to hear from some of you whether you think the hookup culture is a real thing, whether we're characterizing it fairly, whether people have bad experiences or good experiences. You don't have to talk personally, but
you
people
also don't
know.
Have to say your name. We're not going to publicize it, so this is whatever happens in this room stays somewhat in this room, but also kind of not. That's how podcasts work.
Right. Brave person.
Yeah.
Yes.
Woo!
Yeah.
So this is something that I was thinking about as you guys were talking, that I guess something that I've noticed exists is kind of an in-between between the hookup culture that you're talking about and relationships is, I guess, the friends with benefits idea. And I think mm-hmm. that's something that's really popular on the campus, like people who have a go-to hookup. So it's not like every night they hook up with that person, it's a new person, but it's someone that they're consistently having interactions with, and there's almost this disconnect between what the expectations are, and I'm just curious what you guys think about that.
So I just want to jump in here, but don't go back. Stay at the microphone, because I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Now I'm asking you to stand in for everybody your age, the whole world. When I'm looking for a lifetime partner, I'm looking for a friend with benefits. Is that a question? Right? In other words, you want in your life is somebody who you love and adore, who's your best friend, and who you have great sex with. Help me out here. Where does the friend with benefit go awry from there? Oh, wait, somebody in the red sweater wants to answer this one.
I think there's no love. Like, there's a disconnect in the emotions. What was red sweater going to say? You can come join me.
I think also there's, like, no communication, so that if one person is feeling more serious about it, they're totally not wrong in just ending it. They can do anything on their terms because you haven't communicated, like, how serious is this? Are we friends with benefits? Are we looking for, do we adore each other and have great sex? Like, what does that mean? So then things can end, and it's not really clear
Yeah, so there's no such thing as friend with benefits. What there is sex with no communication.
No, I really disagree. No, again, my understanding of this phenomenon is that it sort of saves you the whole worry about hooking up, you know, finding a random person, and maybe it gives you greater safety, but ultimately it's not about taking place in the context of any relationship, of a real emotional connection.
There have also been articles published about millennials and dating and how the game of dating now is who cares less. And I think that plays very significantly into friends with benefits. We're hooking up, but I'm not going to text you the next day or when you need me, and I'm not here emotionally. It's a game of who cares less, even though we still somewhat need each other.
Okay,
I won't let you
know. So then I would call it a bad friend with maybe good benefits, right? Okay. So I would make similar comments as I would make. I mean, if it's a different degree than hooking up with somebody you just met at a party an hour ago, but sort of the same thing. Like, where's the level of trust? Where's the level of being able to communicate? You know, when I'm doing sex ed with 17-year-olds, my basic rule is if you can't talk about it, you shouldn't be doing it. And I feel like that's generally a very good rule. It holds up pretty well over time. You know, good sex happens when there's good communication. And I don't think that that's significantly different. I think my hunch is, I could be wrong, and I'd love some feedback on this, people probably feel a little less bad about themselves after they've had sex with a friend with benefits than with a hookup. I'm not even sure that that's true. But in the end, does it end up making you still feel lonely and empty? Which is not what sex is supposed to do. Sex is supposed to make you connected to somebody and feel happy and joyous and connected.
Yeah, I'll just echo that briefly, which is certainly it's, I'm sure, better in terms of the issue of safe sex and just being safe with the other person, not being taken advantage of. I would assume that that would be less of a concern. Probably the issues we discussed about being responsible and owning what you're doing, I'm sure, is much more... people are in that case. It's a stable relationship. But certainly the issues, going back to the point I made about v'hayu l'basar echad, you know, and the way in which you can think it's all just about getting pleasure, but it really emotionally entangles you with the other person. And as you spoke about, you know, one person can have a different type of emotional investment expectation, feel that their emotions are being toyed with. So when it's not in the context of a real relationship of emotional connection, I think that a lot of the same concerns, a lot of the same issues still apply.
Here's what it really boils down to, in my view. What's the difference between sex with somebody else and masturbation? You can probably have a better orgasm by yourself, most people. I mean, honestly, you know what you want, you know how exactly you want to be touched, and you can have a pretty good orgasm that way. So why would you ever choose to have sex with somebody else? You choose to have sex with somebody else because there's something else going on there. There's a connectedness that goes on there, right? And there's an emotional connection or some kind of interpersonal thing that's going on there. That's what makes sex different than masturbating. So once you've decided you're going to have sex without that emotional connection, I really see very little difference to masturbating. I think masturbating is probably much more effective, actually. But I think what happens is you fool yourself, or you think you're connecting to the person instantaneously for 20 minutes, for 30 minutes, and maybe for 30 minutes or 20 minutes, you are being adored. But then the next day you realize you're not really adored, and then that has pretty negative consequences. So I'm just going to throw it into that category.
Our culture really romanticizes the idea that a casual hookup or friends with benefits or one night stand can turn into something bigger. And there's a lot of movies that come out about a couple that just hooked up and then they stayed friends and they were hooking up and then all of a sudden they're in love with each other and they live happily ever after. So while friends with benefits might be a thing that actually exists, there's just no way that both people are going to feel the same way both times. And what people might be holding on to is this romantic notion that if I stick around long enough, this person's going to realize that they're in love with me, so I'm going to feel upset this whole time until one day this person realizes they love me.
I'm going to give you one more statistic. I think we're over-statisticking tonight, but 4.4% of men and 8.2% of women expect a traditional romantic relationship as an outcome of hooking up, while 29% of men and 43% of women wanted that outcome. So on some level, they're saying they're not really expecting it, but that's what they're hoping. It's like the fairy tale ending, which is exactly what you're saying. It looks like you want to say something.
Hi. So something you were saying a second ago about what's the difference between masturbation and having sex, I think something you missed is that one of the differences is that when you have sex, you feel desired. It's something you talked about a little bit earlier, but I really wonder how much that plays into things with hookup culture, because I think as a bunch of, for lack of a better word, angsty young people who are in a very, very competitive place where it's easy to not feel good about yourself, there's definitely a degree to which, I mean, in my opinion at least, hookup culture exists because of a need to feel desired. It also definitely exists because of a need and desire to feel connected to somebody. But even absent of that, at the kind of shallowest level of wanting to feel desired.
I did say that just a minute ago, but I probably was talking, as usual, way too fast, so I got lost. But that for a minute you feel desired, or for 20 minutes you feel desired, or for 30 minutes you feel desired, but then that's very shallow desire, and then it sort of disappears. But I think you're 100% right. Absolutely.
It also sounds like it might end up being a cycle, because you might feel desired in that moment, but then the feeling of not feeling desired afterward, because maybe you expect someone to call you or text you and then you feel that low, might make you more likely to then go out and try to do it again, or you're upset and you just want a drink because what happened sucked and it really hurt, so I'm going to go find someone else who makes me feel desired. But it could be something that gets someone into a cycle for sure.
I presume there's also an aspect of acting on your own desires, that like you see someone pretty or you know that you can go, it's a sense of control, right? Mm-hmm. Of like being able to get what you want, especially in college when getting the grades you want or succeeding in things you want is not so easy. You go out, you find someone that looks nice, and then you hook up with them. And sort of this control and desire question.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting aspect that we did not touch on at all. It's not just control, it's not just desire, but it's also like the hunt. You're talking about, right? The hunt and the succeeding in the hunt. I think it's an interesting take.
I'm curious to what you guys would think. I've heard a lot on this campus, because it's especially rigorous, that people feel like they don't have time to connect to people, and that hooking up is this short-term thing, and then you don't have to take any responsibility, or you don't have to be emotionally invested. But I find it interesting that people really literally think it would take up more time to connect with someone than to just have an impersonal hookup and then not talk ever again. Sorry, that's kind of extreme.
No. It does take more time. No, I mean, anybody who's in a relationship, come on, guys. Relationships take an enormous amount of time, but that is so sad. I've heard people say that before also. Like, who has time? I'm like in college, I have 17 papers, and you know, who has time for a real relationship? But I don't know, that's so sad.
Before apps, you had to put in the time, but now you can put up a really pretty picture of yourself and you don't actually have to put in the time to look cute and get dressed up and go out and meet someone and have a conversation. You can be sitting in your pajamas on the couch and do the exact same thing, but not just with one person, with hundreds of people at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right, but again, you're just talking to the exactly. person, you're not necessarily having sex with them.
And hasn't anybody ever heard of Shabbos? So isn't that a great opportunity? I'm serious. I'm sure there's a lot of reading that gets done on Shabbos and a lot of other things, but we actually do have some type of space within the week that hopefully gives you an opportunity to connect to human beings. And here it's not just about sex. We do so much connecting through texting and through our phones, and to really have a presence, you know, and to be present. So I don't know. I would question if people really can't find the time if they want to make it.
But also, how sad is that? That at the bottom of our list of time spent is going to be connecting to other people. Like, I don't have time. I have time to take 3 more courses. Mm-hmm. I have time to volunteer for putting together the podcast at Princeton. But I don't necessarily have time for a relationship. And I just think we should be thinking about what that means.
So the thing that I think is funny, too, is that relationships take a lot of time, and that's true. But something else that takes a lot of time is being consumed by social anxiety and being consumed by feeling very self-conscious because you want to feel desired, or the person you like just hooked up with isn't texting you back. And so it doesn't necessarily take any less time
or emotional energy. I think you're right. You. Perceived that way, maybe.
Next up, we answer audience questions. But first, a word from our sponsors.
At Maze Health, we know that if you are having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it is important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Maze is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you are a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there's no solution. Visit us at www.mazehealth.com.
We're going to transition into Act 3, which is questions. The question is, many Orthodox girls are afraid of sex and have trouble having sex when they want to. What would you suggest they do, and how can the Jewish community prevent this?
I love when people ask me these questions that like... I do an hour and a half. I think I've talked about this on other podcasts. I feel like we do a huge disservice, both to the boys and the girls, in the models that we present them about sex. I think we need to do a much better job encouraging girls to learn their own bodies, to figure out what feels good to them, not be afraid of feeling sexual themselves. I think we do a really big number with trying to get girls to what is often termed as bitsanua, be modest. And I feel like often it's counterproductive. I was just talking to a sex therapist from Modi'in in Israel, and she said to me, it drives her nuts because the mothers are always coming in saying, oh, my daughter, she's starting to dress kind of inappropriately. And, you know, part of the discussion with the daughters is how to feel good about your body. But honestly, I feel like the concern is so the other direction. Like if I had a teenage girl who was dressing sexy, I'd say, you know what, for right now, if that feels right for you, you go for it. I feel like we're so worried about not being modest that we end up making people sort of hide their sexuality, feel crummy about their sexuality. And in the end, many, many women don't feel good about their bodies. So feeling good about your body is really important. And that may mean being a little sexier than your yeshiva high school feels like is appropriate. So I feel like those are the messages we need to be telling our girls. And I don't ever think it's too late. You know, I'll often have women patients who come to me who grew up in religious homes and really feel like they shut down their whole side of themselves, their erotic side of themselves. And it's a problem. And we have to work together on reopening it. You always can. When I talk to patients, I'll often say, you know, if you want to learn to do math and you do math problems, that whole part of your brain gets better. It's not just that you get better at those particular math problems, right? That whole part of the brain, there's more synapses, there's more blood flowing. You start using that part of your brain better. And I feel like learning how to use the erotic part of your mind is really important for religious girls because they've really shut it down largely. And so some of that is feeling sexy, trying to figure out what makes you feel sexy, what makes you feel like you want to flirt, what things feel good to you. All of those pieces are kind of re-engaging with the erotic part of the mind, and it's something that really has to happen. Is there something you want to add?
Yeah, I just echo what you say, that I think that even though men and women and boys and girls are told that they have to wait till marriage for sex, I think for whatever reason, for girls, it translates into a shutting down of their sexuality in a way that for boys it does not. And part of this might have to do with issues about tzniut and attitude towards the body and so on. So I think that that is a big challenge, and I really echo what you said in terms of what we can do to change that. And I would say that from a halachic point of view, female masturbation is much less, if any, of an issue than male masturbation. Ironically, though, I am sure that it's happening a lot more among the men than among the women. So I think that addressing a new idea of what snoot really means, and it's not about denying your sexuality and covering up your body, there's a completely different type of a way of thinking about snoot, and really understanding that if we want couples to be in a happy marriage, then we have to work on this issue before they get married as well. So we have two questions here. One is, can you comment on what has changed in the Orthodox community in the past 10 to 15 years with respect to attitudes towards homosexuality? And the other one is, what if I'm gay? Which I assume means, how does any of this conversation relate to me if I'm gay, what we were talking about in terms of hookup culture and so on. So I'll start with the first one. I think that there has been a tremendous sea change in the broader culture as well. I'm not sure if you can remember that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the idea that this was perverse, you didn't talk about this and acknowledge it. I mean, there's been radical change in terms of attitudes towards this. The media and entertainment media in particular has had a huge impact on this because you turn on the TV, you know, and you see Ellen and other various shows where people are gay couples or just it's totally embraced and accepted as normal. And that has had a huge impact. And then we had the Supreme Court decision. So my impression is that whether you're Democrat or Republican, whether you're an Orthodox Jew or somebody else, for people growing up that are in their 20s right now, it's almost taken for granted. You can correct me if you have a different impression. My impression is it's taken for granted that how could we think that it's ethical to discriminate somebody just because they're gay? Of course, everybody's entitled to be married. Why should it matter if you're gay or if you're straight? That's my impression, which is becoming sort of the default attitude. So I think that you find that in the Orthodox community as well, amongst young people, and I think that that's creating a real challenge within the Orthodox community. How can Orthodoxy and Halacha continue to speak in a way in which it feels it's connecting to people's values if they feel on this area that there's a big disconnect? So I think that that's a challenge, and I think that the first way to address that is to just make our space spaces as welcoming and non-discriminatory as possible, whether that's the schools, the shuls, you know, any type of an institution, you can make people feel respected and equal and know that they are equal. And there's a lot to be done without getting to the halachic issues that can, I think, help realign young people's values in this regard and where the larger country is going and what halacha and the Torah says about this.
I'm going to respond to the next question, which is, I'm sorry if the conversation until this point sounded fairly heteronormative, but the reality is every single thing I said, or I think all of us said probably, applies to gay relationships as well as straight relationships. I don't think hooking up is any more productive in the gay community than it is necessarily in the straight community.
And I want to say something as well, because I think that one of the benefits of talking about a Jewish ethics about sex and not just Jewish halacha is that you can apply all of the same discussion that we had about those ethical issues to a gay relationship as to a heterosexual relationship. So this actually provides tremendous opportunity to talk about, you have two gay men or two gay women, and they say, okay, so halacha doesn't sanction this, but is there a way that we can live, be as a couple in a more Jewish way, in a more holy way? What are the things that we should be thinking about in terms of that? So this is where the ability to talk about a Jewish ethics and not just Jewish halacha can make a huge contribution.
I just want to add that the peer pressure we were talking about earlier is maybe more present in the gay community, since there is kind of a stigma that gay men, gay women might have more partners than straight people. And I think that that peer pressure also might lead to the pressure to feel like you have to be hooking up more, to feel like you have to be having more partners or more frequent sex. But I definitely see with my gay friends, there is kind of this expectation and a peer pressure that the assumption is people having much more sex, and that may or may not be the case. And I don't know if it's the same that people are feeling just as unfulfilled, but I do think that the peer pressure is probably stronger in the gay community than the straight community.
Okay, I'm going to read two more, which are also somewhat related. One is, how do you think we should treat issues of Shmirat Negiah among millennials? Should those who struggle with it be open and honest about it, or keep it a secret so as to preserve this perhaps facade that everyone who keeps it is fine with it? So that's a question about Shmirat Negiah. And then in another area of halacha, we have a now former partner recently told me that I, quote, am contributing to my own oppression by wanting to have a nida practice and caring about Negiah. It's clear to me that it was wrong of him to say this to me, definitely, but I can't shake the feeling that what he said is true. Do you think Nida and Nagia are inherently misogynistic? So, you have a whole podcast for any one of those. Obviously, I do want to say, and it should go without saying, that it's very manipulative to be saying, well, you're being oppressed by this halacha, if the point is that this halacha is getting in the way of me getting what I want. But in terms of the issue, look, I think that with a lot of areas of halacha, when you find an area of halacha that you feel that the values in the Torah are a certain thing and they're not in sync with your own values, you have three choices. You can feel, I'm going to reject this because it's not in sync with my value, or I'm going to do it and feel extremely alienated from it. That's one choice. Another choice is apologetics. I'm going to find a way to say that this really meant something that it didn't mean. I'm going to convince myself that this meant something very beautiful. A third approach, which sounds like apologetics but is significantly different in that it retains intellectual honesty, is called transvaluing. And transvaluing means I acknowledge that originally it had a value which I feel very distant from or very much in conflict with. But I'm going to own this in a way that I'm going to associate with it and connect to it in terms of a value that speaks to me. And I feel that there are definitely women who do that in terms of the need to practice. They feel that this is an area in which women have real sense of autonomy and control over this area of halacha. Many women find going to the mikvah can be a very beautiful thing. And I'm not going to tell you how you should feel, but I do think that a way of addressing this is feeling about, how do I want to own this? Can I own this in a way that I can really make this something that gives religious meaning to me and to my life and to my relationship? So I guess I'll pause there before I move on to the Negiah issue.
Because I want to address the Negiah issue. So I think it's a really fascinating question. So if I'm not going to keep Negiah, at that point, do I pretend that I am or do I not? I mean, I feel like that's a really practical question that a lot of people face. I think I would frame it a little bit differently. I think I would frame it from a position of, if we are serious about keeping halacha, then halacha is paramount. When and if we think halacha is really jutting up or bouncing against another value that is very important to us, then we have to start playing with the boundaries there and trying to figure out where we end up. So, for example, if I think in general that not touching each other is halachically the correct way to go, when is that a problem? It's a problem when I'm in a relationship and I'm thinking of taking this relationship to the next level and I'm thinking of making this into a long-term relationship and I'm getting more involved in the relationship, and then it becomes very problematic to not be involved physically with the person. So that's when you have to start kind of playing and looking at the rules. For example, that's why I would feel like it's hard to make a case that hooking up with somebody on a one-night stand is an important thing to do in terms of a long-term relationship, right? But if you're saying I'm in a relationship right now and for the relationship to grow in a healthy, meaningful way, we need to have some kind of physical contact, that seems to me like a reasonable argument to make. And that's when you get into the mikvah, not mikvah issue. I don't know why you necessarily need to have physical contact in public. That becomes the next step, right? When we're talking about PDA, public displays of affection. So does that add to anything? Does that make a point? It's almost like if there's another halacha that I, for some reason, cannot keep, do I need to make that into a public activity, or can I just keep that as a private activity? And so my vote would be for us all to have a little bit more respect for the fact that halacha is complicated and people keep it in different ways and maybe have conversations about it, but not necessarily to flaunt the fact that we're ignoring halacha in certain situations.
I think that that's great because it addresses the issue about, can we both be honest with this and maintain the community values around this? I fully agree that we have to own this more, be more honest about this, start talking about this. You know, it's interesting. The Daf Yomi just recently finished a whole chapter on dealing with issues about ribbis, about charging interest. And a point that I made throughout was, it's fascinating when the Gemara is willing to acknowledge that there's an area of halacha that is regularly being violated. You don't find that when the Gemara discusses Shabbos, but when the Gemara discusses Shemitah, you find it regularly acknowledges that people are not keeping it. And the same was true about ribbis. And I think that we can own that, we can accept that, and therefore we can be more responsible with how we deal with that. And we can talk about, Akshava's point about talking about it, and at the same time talking about where to draw lines, and halacha recognizes different degrees and different lines, and where our values would be around these issues, how to make informed choices. And I think the point about keeping certain things private rather than doing them in public is a very helpful way in terms of addressing the issue of community norms. So I fully think that we are doing everybody a disservice by pretending none of this goes on and leaving people without the tools to make wise and informed decisions.
Next up, we'll get the final word. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Chovei Torah is proud of its new class of 13 rabbis, which brings our total to 108 rabbis now serving the Jewish community. Modern Orthodox rabbis making a difference in the world, in the United States, in Europe, and in Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovei Torah rabbi, come visit us. Our website is www.yctorah.org.
Today's final word, Dr. Marcus, is
vaginismus. So if you've been at our Shabbat table at any point in the last couple of years, you know what this is. Vaginismus is a condition in which women can't get a penis into the vagina. It can be so bad that the penis can't get in it at all, or it can be not so bad and she can get it in, but it hurts tremendously. Generally, it's due to tightened muscles. The reason I wanted to use this as our final word is because it's very prevalent. It's like 7 to 15% of women have this problem. Nobody talks about it. And so sometimes women take years to come in. We've had women come in who've been married for years and years and never dealt with it. It's so easily treatable. So I urge you to take seriously this word vaginismus. We should put in red letters over all the women's dorms. Make sure all your friends can put tampons in. You can look it up on our website. And just know, if you have a friend who you suspect has this condition, it's really easily treatable. It's definitely not something that's worth wasting many years worrying about.
So I will give the parallel word. Believe it or not, there is a parallel word for this in the Gemara, or at least in the poskim. They discuss a condition referred to as otem berechem. Otem is an obstruction, and rechem often means womb, but it often is a euphemism for the vagina. And this comes up in a halachic literature, because the problem is that if the man cannot penetrate his wife, then he ejaculates outside of his wife, and is that a problem about the spilling of seed, and do they have to get divorced? divorced as a result. You know, how do they manage that situation? And it's heartbreaking because you read this and then you realize that this is a phenomenon that was totally treatable, assuming that we're dealing with the same phenomenon, and how many people agonized and how many marriages possibly broke up as a result of this. But you actually find it entering into a number of areas within the halachic literature.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you all.
Yay! Can you tell us what Stitcher is? Tell me.
Stitcher? I'm teasing. If you have questions for the show, you can submit them anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org. Thank you to the students of Princeton for joining us for this live recording. The Joy of Text is produced by Jewish Public Media, which is supported in part by a grant from Next and Natan. This episode was recorded by Mike Hurst. You can listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or with any podcast app. My name is Raimi Smith. Thank you so much for listening.